From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. After months of denying the importance of wearing masks, at times calling them a double-edged sword, the president pivoted last night.
If you can, use the mask. When you can, use the mask. If you're close to each other, if you're in a group, I would put it on when I'm in a group.
Well, a recent study named Arizona, the most mask-resistant state in the country. No state mandate there, though mayors are allowed to require them. And Arizona is now a state struggling on every coronavirus metric. The one-week stats show a 25% rise in deaths, 952 hospitalizations. And while the CDC's goal for positive tests is under 5%, Arizona's is 23.8. In Tucson, in Pima County, the city council approved the use of the downtown convention center as a field hospital for COVID-19 patients, and a free testing center recently opened at the Kino Event Center. Dr. Teresa Cullen is director of public health for Pima County. She joins us by Skype. Dr. Cullen, give us a snapshot of Tucson. We saw figures earlier this week showing ICU beds at 90% capacity in Pima County, just 11 beds free. What's the latest?
So Pima County is over 1 million people, though the vast majority, almost all of our ICU beds happen to be in the major metropolitan area, which is Tucson. Our ICU beds have been running at almost near capacity on many days. The static number is about 4 to 5 beds available in the city. However, yesterday we did see a little bright spot and we had about 12 to 14 beds open. We still are very limited in capacity, however.
And I'm sure you're also not going to rest. And part of that is right. This testing, right, to break the cycle. That's what testing does, you know, to track down people who might be positive, isolate them, trace back people they've had contact with. We're seeing reports of people waiting weeks, in one case 26 days, to get results. How about for you there? How bad has it been?
We've also had those same reports where people calling us. The other day, somebody called me and said they were tested on July 7th and still did not have their data back. Obviously unacceptable. However, in response to the need, our county endorsed standing up an indoor testing center, indoor because of the weather here, the heat can be so overwhelming for people. We're seeing about 500 to 700 people a day come in and get tested. The testing is free. Test results are being reported within 24 to 48 hours. Obviously, our goal is 24 hours. People that get tested are asked to isolate until their tests are back so we can protect the community during that time period. Our positivity rate, about 12 to 14%. Some days it's higher, some days it's lower. What's most striking is our test results in our asymptomatic people. We ask them whether they're symptomatic or not. We separate them out when they come in to make sure we limit our infection. Of our asymptomatics, about 30% are positive.
Hmm. Wow. So people who are asymptomatic and positive, you have a high rate of those. And what's your rate of people who have symptoms, by the way?
It's about 25%.
Are people coming out to be tested? Because we wanted to ask you about this notion that people are resistant to masks in the state of Arizona. Are they resistant to tests?
It doesn't appear that way. However, our population is over 1 million people, right? And our testing center is in Tucson. So there's many rural areas that right now are struggling to get testing availability.
By the way, can you explain again the importance of testing? The president has expressed frustration. His feeling had been, if you test, then your number of cases increases. You find out about cases, and that looks bad. But why is it a good thing to test?
Testing your population enables you to identify people that have the disease, whether they are symptomatic or not. That is the only way we're going to be able to stop transmission, because if you have COVID-19 and you are asymptomatic, we need to know about that so we can work with you to try to isolate you for that disease transmission period. The reason why our numbers have gone up is because our community transmission rate, the number of people that have the disease, has increased.
We know that 87 Arizona doctors just wrote to your governor, Doug Ducey, urging him to keep the schools closed until at least October. Do you agree? Can schools open while you still have this huge transmission rate?
what we share with our community is a dashboard that we've developed of 9 items that allow us to look at the disease itself, the ability for the clinical system to respond, and the response of the public health system. At this point today, 6 of those 9 indicators are red. They have been red for the last month. We are trying to base our recommendations to the schools on science. And right now, based on the science that we see in these 3 areas that most people agree are the critical domains to pay attention to, it would be difficult to recommend opening schools.
And one last question, Dr. Cullen. We mentioned that the state has been ranked one of the worst when it comes to wanting to wear masks. Last night, President Trump did a pivot on masks, said they're good, said that, you know, I have one. Here it is in my pocket. You live there in Arizona. Do you think that will have an impact on people there?
I do. I think that our leaders, by embracing masks and helping educate the public about how important they are, that they will have an impact on people's individual decisions.
Dr. Teresa Cullen, Public Health Director for Pima County, Tucson, where a free testing center was unveiled a week ago. Dr. Cullen, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Let's get the latest now on the Trump administration's call for unauthorized immigrants to be excluded from the census numbers used to allocate seats in Congress. Under the Constitution, the government is required to conduct a census every 10 years to figure out which states are growing in population and which states are declining. So their political power is proportional to how many people live there. But the Constitution says that count shall be determined by adding up the whole number of free persons in each state, not citizens like the Trump administration is trying to claim, which means this move is likely to spark legal challenges. For more, let's bring in Thomas Sines. He's president of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Thomas, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Happy to join you.
Before we get into this issue, I want to ask you, some people might wonder, why do undocumented immigrants get counted towards a state's population when it comes to determining things like seats in Congress? Why has this always been the tradition until now?
Because the wording of the Constitution is quite clear on this issue. It requires an actual enumeration of all persons residing in the United States. So certainly when the Constitution was framed, residing meant what it sounds like. Everyone who's living in the United States should count. Now, that makes sense at the time the Constitution was framed because there were many people living in the states who didn't have the ability under the law to vote or have any of the other rights associated with citizenship. So from the very beginning, we've included in the count every person living in each state.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the Trump administration is trying to change this norm so that undocumented immigrants are excluded from the count?
Well, it's hard to discern the real motivation, except that it is one more instance in which Donald Trump has targeted the Latino community and the growing political power of the Latino community. But it seems like a gesture that will have no impact given how clear the Constitution is. As you suggested, there will be legal challenges. Indeed, there already are legal challenges. Mm-hmm. He will lose those legal challenges. So it is unlikely to have any practical effect. So you look at what its rhetorical effect is, and it seems as though it's one more attempt to divert attention from the administration's failed leadership under the pandemic. And in addition, it is a dog whistle, if you will, to the far right that seems to appreciate every time Donald Trump targets those who are not citizens in the country.
What states would be most impacted by this decision to exclude immigrants?
The states that would lose if his request were to become the law are states like California, like Texas, like Florida, like New York. These are states with large populations that traditionally have attracted immigrants of all statuses. The irony here is that one of the states that probably would take the biggest hit is a state that has in recent years, supported Donald Trump and his political party, and that's the state of Texas.
I have one last question for you. You know, some polls are showing attitudes towards immigrants changing favorably since the pandemic began. Possibly more Americans are seeing immigrants serving on the front lines. But also DACA has been upheld. The citizenship question on the census was struck down. Based on your work, do you see a consensus forming?
Well, I think there's been for a long time a consensus about certain of these issues. It's just that we have leadership in the U.S. Senate and in the White House that acts directly contrary to that consensus. There's overwhelming support for the DACA initiative, but more broadly, I think there is generally a view that when you face challenges like the pandemic, the best response is to unite as a national community, which is also why Donald Trump's continued efforts to divide are so directly contrary to what you would expect to occur in the most successful countries when you face a serious challenge like the COVID-19 pandemic.
That's Thomas Sines, president of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Thomas, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now, where independent minds get their start.
As schools try to open during the pandemic, they're also opening during a race moment in America. How will they handle that? We recently spoke with Zakiya Jarrett, a Black sixth grade teacher in Milton, Massachusetts, who was temporarily removed because of remarks she made about police violence in the killing of George Floyd. After an uproar over her removal, the school district pledged to consider an anti-racism curriculum. Some schools already have one in place. Some are trying and finding it hard. The Miami-Dade School Board is in the middle of a fierce debate, as we'll hear. But first, last year in a largely white school district in Charlottesville, Virginia, school board members passed an anti-racism program called Reframing the Narrative. John Hobson is the project leader. John, we know this is for social studies classes in middle and high schools in Albemarle County. Students encouraged to ask questions, interrogate power. Tell us more.
So, for instance, we've been working on a lesson related to George Floyd and talking about the power of names. Say his name, George Floyd, and connecting that to free people wanting to change their names after the Reconstruction period.
Oh, so taking it back through history to point out how important it is to say someone's name when a name was so hard fought for.
That's right. And so what saying your name does is it humanizes people, you know, it affirms their humanity. But really, to humanize the individuals in history or in the present moment that we want students to examine, so that it's not, history is not seen as something as inert or in the past, but it's very much affecting our present moment.
Well, so you have six districts in the state, program with about 80 social studies teachers. You are white. Have you had the same kind of collision that it sounds like Milton, Massachusetts saw, which was an African-American teacher feeling perfectly comfortable addressing a subject that many of the white supervisors were not?
Yeah, I think I certainly have to acknowledge my privilege and certainly my responsibility in my position right now to speak up for voices that sometimes get marginalized or pushed to the side. In many cases, people like me have not been out front and have not been good allies. So I think it's important in this time to certainly step forward.
But what kind of feedback do you get from students, white students or Black students?
Ultimately, the feedback has been very powerful. I think a lot of students have been really upset with us in the past when they, you know, discover, for instance, that Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner, which, believe it or not, you know, people in Albemarle County, you know, where Thomas Jefferson's home, Monticello, is, that fact has been concealed in many cases. Now, Monticello is doing a great job of telling that story now, but I think there's been years and years of kind of telling a narrative that sort of conceals that history. And so I think similarly, students really get frustrated and angry with their teachers when they feel like something's being hidden from them. And so the students are really pushing us. And in fact, the anti-racism policy that was developed was developed by students.
And how do you deal with discomfort? You know, it's maybe a necessary byproduct of some of these lessons, but it's one thing to be a little uncomfortable. It's another thing to have shame, feel blame. You know, we've heard these different things from young people, that young Black students sometimes are uncomfortable around this because they don't want to be seen as victims, or white students don't want to be blamed for something they may have had nothing to do with. We asked Zakiya Jarrett about that. She tried to make sure they saw it wasn't their fault. How do you address that discomfort if it comes up?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, there are a lot of good resources out there that help us and our teachers do this, in particular, Facing History in Ourselves, which is an organization we've done a lot of professional learning with, that have kind of guides and a process you might go through before having a difficult conversation. And it involves really, one, just looking inward at yourself and sort of considering, you know, the kind of feelings that you have and the, you know, potential biases that you have. And then secondly, considering your students. You know, who are these students in front of you and what potential feelings might they bring? And I think it's important that students are given the space to kind of construct their own knowledge and understanding. And so giving them resources to help them understand is really powerful. And then giving them outlets for sort of wanting to do something with this information. It's transferring something they just learned, you know, whether that's, you know, the murder of George Floyd or any other topic, and thinking about, okay, what are the lessons that are drawn from that? You know, maybe it's something about the history of police violence. To think about, okay, what can I do with that information? But I think that's really the goal of social studies. It's not for them just to become receptacles of facts, but really to sort of understand their past so that they can act in their present moment.
John Hobson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that's being heralded as a successful anti-racism policy. Let's go now to Miami, where last month the board of the Miami-Dade County Public Schools voted 8-1 in favor of introducing an anti-racism curriculum and ran right into opposition. Jessica Bakeman has been covering this for WLRN in South Florida. Jessica, this is one of the country's largest school districts, 72% Hispanic, about 20% Black, 7% white. Describe the suggested curriculum.
Right. So we don't know exactly what the curriculum will look like yet. Basically, what the school board has done is direct the superintendent to do a review of the existing curriculum dealing with racism and multiculturalism, and then also develop or enhance curriculum dealing specifically with anti-racism, and also empower a student task force to discuss this issue and report quarterly back to the school board. So on August 12th, the superintendent will bring that report to the school board, and they can figure out going forward what exactly that anti-racism curriculum will look like.
Yeah. Well, as we said, board members voted 8-1 approving that plan and got some support, but a lot of opposition. From whom? What were people saying?
Well, this discussion took place at a couple of virtual school board meetings, but hundreds of people wrote emails and flooded the school board staff with phone calls. Unfortunately, there was this misinformation campaign. It said that the proposal would require the school district to adopt a curriculum developed by Black Lives Matter activists, which is not the case. And it also said that the curriculum would require teaching about homosexuality and transgender issues, which again was not true. And then there were some comments like, because of the election of President Barack Obama and the fact that there are wealthy Black celebrities like Oprah Winfrey and LeBron James, that was proof that somehow racism no longer exists.
Mm. Well, as we said, only one member of the board voted against the plan. Her name is Marta Perez. She's Cuban American. She said the plan will be a distraction from COVID-19. Here's a clip of her speaking during a virtual committee meeting in June.
In my opinion, this school district is a shining example throughout the years of inclusion in all matters, including race, ethnicity, disabilities, etc. If there has ever been a wrong, we have stepped up and corrected it very quickly.
Jessica, give us context for that.
That was her response during the initial discussion about this proposal for an anti-racism curriculum. The plan was sponsored by her colleague, Dorothy Bendross Mindengal, another school board member who is Black and herself was actually a victim of the school district's racism in the past. Back in 1947, when she was just a little girl, the school board and the city of Miami evicted her family and 34 other Black families from their homes and took their land by eminent domain in order to make way for an all-white school. So that comment that Dr. Perez said, saying that, you know, these any injustices that have happened have been quickly corrected, she basically made that right to a person who herself was a victim of these injustices.
That's an incredible story. And Dr. Dorothy Bendross Mindengal referenced that personal story in responding to Perez at that June meeting. Let's listen to that.
I'm the little girl who was put out of my house at 3 years old in the rain so that they could build a school. How dare you? It didn't stop there.
Boy, Jessica, this is, as we said, it's hard, and this is sounds very hard. You also heard from teachers, some who believe the school district isn't doing enough to educate staff. Talk about that.
Yes. So I spoke with Kaylin Lee. She was the rookie teacher of the year for the school district in 2020. She's a Black English teacher at a high school that Trayvon Martin actually attended at one point. She and some other people are saying that they want to see, you know, more leadership from the school board to foster a culture of anti-racism, starting by really listening to Black teachers, parents, and students about their experiences.
Yeah. So, Jessica, we're seeing in this debate over an anti-racism curriculum a deeper sense of the city's race relations. Talk about that.
Sure. So Miami-Dade County is very diverse. And because of that, many people in Miami believe that the city is somehow above racism or beyond racism. I spoke to a Cuban American history professor at Florida International University in Miami, and he put it like this: there's a lot of denial of anti-Black prejudice in Hispanic and Latino communities in South Florida. And there are historical and current examples of white or white passing Hispanic or Latino people enjoying privilege and political power that Black communities there don't have access to.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like even just the suggestion of an anti-racism curriculum is sparking a deeper conversation about that. But what is the situation now? I mean, where do we leave this plan to have that curriculum?
Well, the superintendent is going to report back to the school board on August 12th. And I know that the district, since the passage of this item, has already taken some action in terms of the virtual summer school that's been going on this summer, incorporating discussions with students about the death of George Floyd. And also they've had some professional development with teachers this summer about racism and anti-racism in the classroom.
Jessica Bakeman with WLRN in South Florida, taking a deep look at a plan in Miami-Dade County to institute an anti-racism curriculum. We'll follow this story with you, Jessica. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Is your school planning a curriculum? Let us know. HereAndNow.org.
Boeing's troubled 737 MAX aircraft is probably still months away from carrying passengers again, but the Federal Aviation Administration is taking steps toward that day. The FAA said yesterday it plans to issue a proposed airworthiness directive for the grounded jetliner in the near future. The 737 was grounded in 2019 after crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia killed 346 people. Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now. And Seth, first remind us why those planes crashed and what Boeing has been trying to fix on this 737 MAX.
Tanya, in simplest terms of all, basically the plane, or its systems anyway, were trying to correct for a problem that didn't actually exist. And then the correction caused the problem. So a bit more detailed. A bad sensor told the plane that it was stalling. And the way you get out of a stall, kind of counterintuitive for those of us maybe who aren't pilots, but you actually kind of dive. You point the nose down to regain airspeed. the problem was the plane wasn't stalling. It pointed the plane down, and the plane kept going down until it ultimately crashed in both cases. And the pilots, even though they knew something was wrong, they weren't able to overcome that system.
Yeah, the details are horrifying. How is Boeing evaluating whether those changes are making the 737 MAX safer?
Right. And so one thing they've done is they've now required those systems to rely on two sensors. Both sensors would have to indicate a stall rather than just one. That was part of the problem last time, that bad sensor. And they've given the pilots more control now. But they're taking these planes through test flights, through simulator training on the ground, and basically simulating those same conditions so that if the same thing happened, you know, would the pilots be able to take back control? And it's not, of course, just Boeing evaluating that. It's the FAA and all of its counterparts around the world, where there's accusations that the FAA and Boeing were too cozy. The rest of the world's not going to just take the FAA's word for it. Regulators everywhere also will have to sign off on this.
What's the timeline now for getting to that point where this plane is again carrying passengers? And don't you think people are going to be a bit apprehensive? I mean, also pilots were speaking out about this, saying they don't want to fly these planes until they can be 100% assured that this 737 MAX is safe.
Yeah, incredibly, Tanya, there's a realistic scenario now where it will have been 2 years. It was March of 2019 when the second crash happened and the planes were shortly grounded. It could be almost March of 2021 before the planes are flying again. In the initial moments after that second crash, people were saying, well, is it going to be weeks or months? It's going to be years, likely years plural, literally 2 years before passengers are flying on that plane again.
Yeah, with the 30 seconds I have with you, we know that airlines are hemorrhaging right now because of the pandemic. What are the latest numbers, and can the airline industry actually recover from this pandemic?
Yeah, United Airlines, the latest to report earnings, or really lack thereof, lost $1.6 billion, or even more than that, more than $2 billion if you strip out some accounting noise. Delta lost even more than that last year, and no prospect anytime soon for things getting better, especially with the second wave. More people are flying now than were flying a few months ago, Tanya, but still far fewer than what these airlines need in order to be profitable.
Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, as always. Thank you, Seth.
Thank you, Tanya.
When you stumble across a locally owned or minority-owned radio station, it comes as a jolt after the cookie-cutter sounds of corporate stations that now clutter the airwaves. Here's a sampling of Black-owned stations in Los Angeles, Chicago, Springfield, Massachusetts, and Jackson, Mississippi.
It is the D.L. Hughley Show. We got a great show lineup for you. But before we get to that, The pandemic still rages, taking the lives and hospitalizing many Americans, many people around the world. Also, so does the battle for equality and justice. The uprisings still continue to happen, so we have a moment of silence. All right, coming up, Jen.
Radio Free, 102.3 KJLA. Lauryn Hill, Lost Ones. Got to send a shout out to my crew, Felicia, Renee, and Becky, checking us out. Seal Beach, First Responders.
And all the rappers in the top 10, please allow me to bump.
I want to go back in time. When did this song come out? Can we go back in time? I want to go back to the 90s. The 2000s suck, y'all.
We make a point of telling you the names of the songs that we play. We are 106.3 Smooth FM. That is Tim Watson. It's called Life of the Party. Who's the life of the party in your house? I know. I know. Hey, folks, coming up next.
But of the 11,000 commercial radio stations in the U.S., fewer than 180 are Black-owned. And that last one there is owned by Carol Moore Cutting. She's president, CEO, and general manager of Cutting Edge Broadcasting, WEIB-FM, a jazz station in western Massachusetts. We wanted to talk to her about her own story, but also the dearth of locally owned, minority-owned radio stations. Last month, Carol signed her name to a statement from a national group of Black broadcasters asking the government to get involved again in increasing the number of women and minority-owned stations. We'll explain. Carol, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's hear a little of your story first. You'd come to Massachusetts from the South with your husband. What compelled you about a radio station?
Well, coming from the South, I was really surprised when there were no African-American or anything that I could relate to culturally, or there was no diversity in the market. And so we had no idea where we could find simple things that we needed to connect to the community of color.
Well, where to get your hair done, maybe, or
church. Yep. Exactly. Yep. And I was surprised because I was sure in progressive New England, it would be totally different. And coming from that Tuskegee University, Booker T. Washington kind of spirit of believing that you needed to do what you could in the community, cast down your bucket where you are, and make a difference. And yep. So that's what I tried to do.
And we should be clear, you are a Black woman from the South who landed in New England as Boston was in the middle of a race crisis over busing. Your dream to start a radio station was born in about 1970. Lots of research at the library followed. You applied for a construction permit to build in 1984 and went through a protracted battle for 15 years because someone else wanted the broadcast license. They're very difficult to get. So let's back up, because there's a history of racism in broadcast licensing. The government began awarding the airwaves in the 1930s. All of these early licenses went to white men. In the 1970s, the FCC tried to remedy this with a minority ownership policy. That would give a tax break to people willing to sell to minority owners. And that worked. Minority ownership increased. But then in 1995, that tax break was overturned by the Republican-led Congress, and all that success was undone. We hear the statistics now. But you were buffeted by these wins all along and finally did win the license. You launched in 1999. So what became your role? I see pictures of you with wonderful-looking young people of color, so obviously there's mentoring. There's bringing in voices of color. But how else would you say you are a place where community can gather?
Mentoring is very important, because I would not have this radio station if I had not turned on the television and saw another African-American woman on the airwaves in Hartford, Connecticut.
Gail King.
Yes. Well, she doesn't remember properly who I am or the significance she played in my life as a broadcaster. But I was so in a bind as to whether or not it was worth it for my family that I called her and said, "You don't know me, but I'd like to speak with you." And I explained the situation in my quest for the broadcast license. And she was very encouraging. And so I felt stronger and felt, oh, well, I can continue to do this. And we did. Now, I try to make sure that if people are interested in anything, I try to be that role model for women. And so our children or our young people, what do we do in the community? We focus a lot on the activities that are going on in the community, positive things, and try to be there to support organizations that are also doing things to help out our community.
Well, and I can hear listeners saying whether or not it's minority owned, and it is, that's hugely important. Most communities are missing a radio station that's local because of media consolidation. I mean, I'm sure you see that as one of the biggest problems.
It's definite.
Clear Channel. Yeah.
Oh, it's definite. Corporate broadcasters have the resources and what have you that I, as an independent, I don't have. And so we have to be very resourceful.
Yeah. Well, Clear Channel, which is now called iHeartMedia, wiped out locally, much of the locally owned radio, you know, just buying up stations across the country, which is why they all sound alike. So you've signed on to a letter from the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters outlining the failings in the diversity of media ownership. I'm imagining that top of your checklist is maybe bring back that tax incentive so that owners once again have an incentive to look beyond the white owners that they know from corporations like Clear Channel?
Well, absolutely. It would be so much better, because during that period when it was in existence, the number of black and people of color and female owners increased. And when we lost that incentive, it meant that there was no reason to sell to people of color.
We know there was legislation introduced by Congressman G.K. Butterfield, H.R. 3957, Expanding Broadcast Ownership Opportunities Act of 2019, which would reinstate that tax certificate.
Yes. And so the enactment of that legislation would make a big difference and give existing broadcasters the incentive to sell and to seek out black and minority-owned women and women broadcasters in this country.
You're also asking for other changes in the industry. You want advertisers to invest in black-owned radio stations, buy airtime. The government also buys time for ads. You want those dollars as well. And you want people of color to hold corporate board seats at broadcast stations. Do you think all of this is especially possible during this moment of change?
I certainly hope so, because it's really sad when in 2020, Carol Moore Cutting is the only locally owned commercial radio station, AM or FM, owned by blacks in this whole New England area. That is sad. So I hope so.
That's Carol Moore Cutting. By the way, at hereandnow.org, we'll link you up to her station if you're in other parts of the country. Again, owner of Cutting Edge Broadcasting in Western Massachusetts and creator of WEIB FM Radio. Carol, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you for the opportunity on behalf of all the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters.
We'll also post a directory of black-owned radio stations and the statement that Carol signed demanding change in the broadcast industry at hereandnow.org.
President Trump is hosting an event today about plans to combat violent crime in American cities. It's the latest example of the law and order message he's pushing ahead of the November election. Meanwhile, rival Joe Biden has released new details of his economic recovery plan, and NPR political correspondent Asma Hallett joins us with the latest on the 2020 presidential campaign. Hey, Asma. So Trump has always positioned himself as tough on crime, but now he's using presidential events to get the message out when he can't hold these rallies, and his ad campaigns have turned really dark. Let's listen.
The radical left-wing mob's agenda? Take over our cities, defund the police, pressure more towns to follow, and Joe Biden stands with them, cutting police funding.
So Trump's spending millions crafting a narrative that Democratic-led cities are out of control. How has this strategy been working for him?
Well, to be frank, Tanya, it hasn't been. I mean, look, we're still a little less than 4 months from Election Day, so dynamics could change. But at this point in time, Donald Trump is losing badly in the suburbs. And this is a message that is crafted really to those all-important suburban voters. The suburbs are home to about where 50% of voters live. And Trump won those voters in 2016. At this point, he's losing them to Joe Biden by double digits. You know, one thing I think it's worth pointing out, because I do think, you know, candidates focus a lot on suburban voters. And it's kind of this anachronistic view that the suburbs are a place where folks are kind of fear of the other. And there is a bit of a racial element to this messaging, because the suburbs are increasingly really diverse places. The other thing I think that's worth pointing out is that there is a desire in these messages to instill fear in voters, playing up this threat that Joe Biden is soft on crime. The difficulty for a lot of voters that I've spoken with is that that's an abstract fear when they've got immediate fears right in front of them about the virus and the economy.
And speaking of the virus, the president has renewed his coronavirus briefings. He had one last night. He's often downplayed, as we've been talking about in the show today, the severity of the virus. But yesterday, he talked about it getting worse before it gets better, and he emphasized the importance of masks. He also looked forward to vaccines and remained upbeat on the economy. Let's listen to what he said.
The plague, I call it the plague. The plague came in. Terrible thing. Should have been stopped. Wasn't stopped. It came in. We had to shut things down to save potentially millions of lives. We did that. And now we've started them up. And I think we've really started it up very successfully.
Asma, how has his coronavirus response been part of his reelection message?
The coronavirus response has really not been part of his reelection message at all. You know, he has focused on the economy, and some voters would say that he has neglected the public health side of the problem. He's urged businesses to reopen, schools to reopen. He has been defending his administration's response. But at this point, you know, we're dealing with a situation where a number of states are seeing COVID cases continue to rise. And because the president did downplay the severity for a while, I do think it's a particularly challenging message for him to run on in terms of reelection.
Let's talk about presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden. Recently, he's been focusing on an economic message about health care and child care. Let's hear some of his remarks yesterday in Delaware.
This is about easing the squeeze on working families who are raising their kids and caring for aged loved ones at the same time, sometimes separately, but many times together. And it's about creating jobs with better pay and career pathways for caregivers and showing them that dignity and respect that they deserve.
Asma, how does Biden say he'll achieve these goals?
Well, he rolled out a new plan to provide and expand child care and elder care. He's calling for roughly $800 billion investment in that. And this is just one of a series of new economic proposals that he's released in recent weeks. I think what's interesting to me about this is that for many months, in fact, Biden was largely focused on the virus, critiquing how President Trump had handled that. And in recent weeks, we've begun to see a clearer picture of what a, you know, purported Joe Biden presidency would look like in terms of what his own. He's outlined plans to boost manufacturing, you know, increase the number of climate jobs there are, and then this latest plan, which is to expand child care, provide universal pre-K for all 3- and 4-year-olds.
I want to ask you about a running mate. There's been lots of speculation about who Biden may pick. Has he indicated who he favors?
He's asked that question quite a bit, and he has not indicated. He's asked many times, in fact, if he'll choose a black woman in particular, just given the racial protests in this country and the pressure, I think, to have a diverse ticket. And he's been quite clear in saying that he's not going to make any commitments. But in an interview with MSNBC this week, he mentioned that there are 4 black women on his list.
Mm. Before we let you go, what's your assessment of the overall state of the 2020 race?
You know, at this point, Joe Biden leads in pretty much every poll that you see, and he leads in a number of polls in key battleground states. And I think a lot of Democratic voters will tell me that there's a lot of trepidation when they see those polls because they think back to 2016. But analysts point out that this cycle is really different than 2016 because voters have now seen President Trump as president in action, and they have something to judge him on.
A lot to watch in the next few months. That's NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid. As always, Asma, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Language experts say it's time to examine racism in language. Phrases rooted in slavery like blacklisted, master bedroom, and soul down the river.
All of these racially biased terms are part of our language. Those are the data that children are using to learn language.
Next time, Here and Now.